All right, welcome into the Big Three here on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network. Three biggest stories, I would say, of the last, 12 hours or so. First up, this is actually pretty big. Out of the NBA, Dennis Schroeder is now reported that he will be leaving the NBA bubble for the birth of his second child. Keep in mind, at least right now, this is the second player that we know will be doing this. Gordon Hayward of the Boston Celtics will be the other. But players, to give you a sense of what will happen here, can't leave the bubble for excused absences. That includes the birth of a child. Those who leave for excused absences must quarantine for 4 days upon return to the bubble, as long as they test negative for the coronavirus each day they were off campus. So obviously this means, depending on when Schroeder's wife is due, when the child is going to come, he will miss potentially some seeding games, maybe even a few postseason games. A massive deal here for the Oklahoma City Thunder. If you remember in all of our conversations about the Oklahoma City Thunder, the one thing that really makes them go is that three-guard lineup with Schroeder, with Chris Paul, with Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, a plus 31.4 net rating when they're on the floor together. This is going to be a massive loss for them, especially if they get into a postseason series without a guy like Schroeder, because that was going to be the reason why they matched up so well with so many of these other teams that we're going to potentially face. Remember, at this point, they're sitting in fifth place. A matchup with the Utah Jazz is where it stands right now, as the Jazz are in fourth. Behind them, and actually they're tied, 40-24 each. The Houston Rockets sitting in sixth. And then they're still only a game and a half up on the Dallas Mavericks. So obviously potential for them to move up and down regardless of, you know, whether what's going to happen in these seeding games for the Oklahoma City Thunder. But this is by far nothing to sweep under the rug. If Dennis Schroeder is going to miss some playoff games, this is going to be pretty big. And hopefully, if the Oklahoma City Thunder can lock their way into a 5 or 4 seed matchup with the Utah Jazz, gets offset a little bit with how banged up the Jazz are and how poor they've been playing. But at the same time, if the Oklahoma City Thunder, who I thought were going to be in the Western Conference semifinals, winning a first-round matchup, but they need Dennis Schroeder to do it. So again, Dennis Schroeder leaving the NBA bubble for the birth of his second child. Just don't know when that's going to be. By the way, Dennis Schroeder, first kid named Dennis Jr. I don't know how I feel about juniors, but whatever. Yasiel Puig, second story of the day. He's going to sign with the Atlanta Braves. The move comes in response to losing outfielder Nick Markakis. Remember, we had that story with Danny. Was it earlier this week or maybe late last week? Regardless, this is in response to losing Markakis, who has decided not to play this season. Puig, if you remember last year, split time between Cincinnati and Cleveland, a total of 149 games and 611 plate appearances, hit .297 over 49 games with Cleveland down the stretch when he was traded. 2 homers, 23 RBI. Look, Yasiel Puig is not going to be the same guy that he was all those years ago, but you're getting a guy who can hit about .260 over a full season. And again, over a full season in the range of about 20 home runs, maybe a little bit more, over a 60 game sample size. It has yet to be seen, of course, how effective he could be over a short sample size. Is that batting average maybe going to get a little bit worse, considering that Yasiel Puig can be, for lack of a better term, and no pun intended, swing and miss with the way that he performs. So Yasiel Puig is going to be a member of the Atlanta Braves, fills a hole that is left by one Nick Markakis in that, or with that team. And then last but not least, and this is, I don't think this is obviously a big deal. We're talking about intra-squad scrimmages here. Nothing official reported, at least in terms of severity of the injury, but it's something to keep an eye on, because if you remember with our preview for the New York Mets, the one team that is really, I think, going to hold this team back outside of some of the other issues they have is outside of the top of that rotation. There's some real question marks. Remember, Zach Wheeler, no longer with the team. Noah Syndergaard, TJ, not going to be playing. Well, yesterday, Jacob DeGrom left New York's intra-squad scrimmage with back tightness. No real read on whether he's going to miss an extended amount of time, but it's always something you want to keep an eye on with a team like the New York Mets, who could be relying on the pitching. And like we've talked about, right, many times with Major League Baseball in this short sample size of games in a regular season, pitching is going to be at a premium. And if you have guys who can extend games, pitch 6-7 innings, it's going to put you, I think, a step ahead of your competition on a daily basis. But Jacob DeGrom, again, leaving New York's inter-squad start with back tightness, something to keep an eye on as we go around in terms of Major League Baseball and get ready for the season. Also, should note, too, in Major League Baseball, I know it's the Big Three and not a fourth story, but it looks like Yanni Chirinos could miss the start of the season for the Texas Rangers. So keep an eye on that injury as we're getting closer to game time for Major League Baseball. All right, that does it for the Big Three. We have a great show on tap, a lot of soccer, Major League Soccer. Jason Davis is going to join us in just a few moments, talk about what's going down in Florida, plus a little mixed martial arts and much more on the edge here on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network.
This is The Edge with your hosts, Jonathan Von Tobel.
Welcome to everybody joining in here on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network. I am Jonathan Von Tobel. I feel like we have a fantastic show on tap for you today. A lot going on in the world of Major League Soccer. Some interesting trends with totals and numbers popping up. We're going to have Jason Davis on momentarily to discuss that and some of the games coming up, not only tonight, just one, but the three games that we'll see on July 16th, which is tomorrow, and some future odds questions for Jason as well. Pucking around Edmonton versus Chicago. I think this is actually really intriguing from the standpoint of Edmonton offensively. We know how good they are at the top with two of their best players, but some of the numbers in terms of their overall contributions from teammates leave some questions to be asked for the Oilers. Bottom of the hour, of course, UFC Fight Island, two fights that we're really going to discuss in detail, one of which I have bet, and then, of course, D-Block. Everybody loves them. Futures market's a little skewed, and I think they're a little overrated, but the New Orleans Pelicans, part of our Nothing But Analytics series today, as we're going to look at the offensive strengths and weaknesses, of course, defensively as well. The defensive numbers are really weird for the New Orleans Pelicans because there's some really good ones, but the overall efficiency really suffers, and we're going to dive into why that is and maybe explain what exactly is going on defensively with the New Orleans Pelicans. With that, really quickly, I'm going to see if this has come up yet. It has not. Let's see. No, it hasn't. All right. I'll throw out my plays for what's going to go down at the Memorial this weekend in golf at the bottom of the show, because I got quite a few, but not to dive into technical issues that I'm having on my end. But let's head out to the phone line. I believe we have Jason Davis, host, United States of Soccer, SiriusXM FC. You can follow him on Twitter at Davis, JSN. I would assume that's Jason. But Jason, I appreciate some time today, man. You know, I don't know really where to begin, because I'll admit to you up front, right? I'm a little bit of a novice when it comes to Major League Soccer, you know, and the intricacies of these teams and which teams are good, which teams are bad. So let me just start with this. Since they have started this tournament out in Florida, for somebody who watches and covers this sport, has there been anything that you've noticed that has been different with play, whether it be the amount of goals scored, whether it be, you know, quality of play, anything like that, anything that has changed for you since you've watched them in this MLS's back tournament?
I think overall, across the board, teams are definitely not sharp yet. There are teams that have come out of the period of the pandemic and the shutdown and looked okay and looked maybe better than you would expected. But there are a lot of teams that are struggling a little bit. I think maybe some laxness when it comes to set piece defending and those kind of things kind of slip aside when you're not training every day. So those are the kinds of things, if you're looking for goals, if you're looking for, you know, results that jump off the page, things like late winners, things like added time goals, things like that are certainly part of the story so far, at least a couple of places.
Yeah, I think Sporting KC who gave up two goals in extra time at the end of their game the other day? That was ridiculous.
Yeah, Minnesota United with a couple of goals. And if you look at the balance of that game and you're watching it play out, you're thinking, okay, wow, Sporting is a much better team right now than Minnesota United. Now, coming out of the pandemic shutdown, you might not have thought that. I mean, on paper, Sporting had a rough 2019. They looked pretty good in two games, but it was only two games. They made some adjustments and some signings in the offseason that had them looking pretty decent. Minnesota United had won both of their games before the shutdown. So it wasn't as though you would have guessed an unbalanced kind of level of play, but Sporting was much better. And then, yeah, Minnesota United finds two goals in added time, just a breakdown. And if you don't take your chances, if you're Sporting Kansas City, and you don't take the chances that are presented to you over the first 90 minutes of that game, well, you only have yourself to blame that you only got one on the board.
Yep. So I wanted to build on this kind of topic of changes and some of these totals, because I think this is really interesting. And in a lot of these sports, Jason, that are starting to make their way back, right? We're talking about like the NBA, for example. You know, I cover the NBA extensively, and they're talking a lot about these totals, right? For these first eight games they're going to play before the postseason starts. And the totals are much lower than we saw on the board, you know, during the regular season. And so I was going through some of these MLS games. So before I get to some of the observations they made, I wanted to ask you, an average MLS game, right? Like, we're not talking about in a bubble where they're at right now, but like during a regular season, what kind of scoring do we get with an MLS game? Does it tend to be higher scoring than what we see in European soccer and German soccer? What do we get in terms of a regular MLS game in scoring?
You're usually averaging something like three goals a game. It might even be a tick lower than that over the course of the season. Obviously it comes in ebbs and flows, and Major League Soccer is interesting because you know, just like the European leagues, it happens across a vast period of time. But here in the United States, you're also talking about weather being a major factor. You start the season when it's cold, and you go into the summer when it's, you know, 100 degrees outside in places like Houston and the Deep South. And now all of these games, when it comes to MLS at Bat, are being played in hot and humid environments in Orlando. It's one place. Everybody, the playing field is completely leveled when it comes to weather. I think all the teams are struggling. I think fitness has certainly been an issue, but the wrinkle, and this is something that soccer fans are adjusting to, and anybody who's looking at these matches is adjusting to, is the fact that these coaches now can now use 5 substitutions, and they've injected water breaks into these games. So it changes a little bit. How do you calculate? Is fitness going to be an issue? Are you expecting some teams to tire? Or because of the water breaks and the substitutions, do you kind of have to be looking down the bench for these clubs and thinking, okay, who are their game changers, and how might this end up changing the outcome of a game at the end, the way we saw with Minnesota United and Sporting Kansas City?
So the one thing that I noticed, so July 8th is when this all got started. If you go from July 8th to the 12th, the average was about 1.9 goals per game. But the last two nights, the 13th and the 14th, we're talking about 3.8 goals per game. Why would that be? Is just the competition better in the last two nights? Like, why is that such a stark difference from those first four nights to what we've seen the last 2 days?
Well, you had the highest scoring team in the league from 2019 in action, okay, in LAFC. They're also a team that goes for it, that plays very attacking soccer, that leaves them open at the back, and they got countered by the Houston Dynamo effectively, and that's why you get so 6 goals out of one match. I mean, I certainly think that this Toronto FC DC United game that ended up 2-2 is a bit of an aberration. DC didn't look very good on the day. That's another game that kind of got stolen, or at least in terms of a point for Minnesota, or for DC United rather. They kind of stole that game. You know, otherwise I don't know. It's a little bit of the rust. I would imagine it's a little bit of the matchups. You had, you know, an expansion team in action last night in Inter Miami, who gave up 2 goals to Philly. Orlando scored 3 against NYCFC. I'm not sure we would have expected that before the tournament started, because Orlando's never been very good, and NYCFC is the perennial contender at this point.
Yeah, the other thing, and you kind of alluded to it too, and maybe it is the heat of these guys, the rust. By my calculations, you know, I'm not really good at addition, but 38 total goals up to this point, 22 have come in the second half. So like you were talking about maybe a little bit in terms of the heat and wearing these guys down, there's been a lot of scoring in the second half. Do you think that's something that continues?
That's a good question. I think we've seen, you know, in the first couple of games, there was lots of talk, no goals in the first half. I think there was a feeling of each other out. I think physicality and kind of just being bumbling into each other, passes going awry, broke some moves down and meant that we didn't get goals. I would be guessing, but my assumption is that the heat and the humidity and some of the fitness issues are have less of an effect in the second half than the fact that the defenders tire, and that, you know, you can change the game with those substitutions. So you put on a couple of new attacking bodies, guys who have a lot in the tank, and suddenly counterattacks are happening in the 75th, 85th minute. And those defenders are just gassed, and maybe you haven't changed. Maybe this team hasn't changed out any of those guys. And certainly you're going deeper in your bench, and Major League Soccer benches are notoriously not that deep. So coaches maybe don't want to go and add defenders to a game, but they'll throw on attackers. And that's why you might get goals in the second half.
All right, Jason Davis with us again, host of United States Soccer here, 6M FC. All right, let's get into some specific games before we talk about big picture futures. Today, San Jose, Vancouver. San Jose on the three-way, $1.25 favorite. Vancouver plus +295. The draw is the same price as well. Vancouver hasn't played yet, right? Who's that an advantage for, in your opinion?
That's a good question. I think it's San Jose's advantage. Now, San Jose plays a very interesting man-marking style of soccer. It's incredibly intense physically. So it is a question of whether or not they'll be able to hold up over the breadth of the tournament so far. I mean, they did well enough keeping the champion Seattle Sounders off the board in that 0-0 draw that they played. Vancouver comes in, and I think what's interesting there is that they are kind of always a work in progress. Mark Dos Santos was the first-year head coach last year. They had a poor season. They made some significant changes. They went out and spent a bunch of money on a high-priced Canadian talent, Lucas Cavallini, who was playing in Mexico, but he didn't come to the tournament. He opted out. So I'm not sure. I mean, they have a couple of other pieces. Jordy Reyna is a pretty decent attacking player that can make things happen for Vancouver, but they're missing not just Cavallini, but also Freddie Montero, another striker option. So they're going to be going down the bench to get their striker on the field. And I would imagine the way that San Jose plays, that things might tip in San Jose's direction, especially if you consider Vancouver not having a chance to shake off any of that rust.
I like it. All right, three games tomorrow. Atlanta, Cincinnati. Cincinnati, in terms of the futures, is at least the worst team on the board. They're 250-1 to win this whole thing. They gave up four goals in their first game. You think that's apt, though? Cincinnati, worst team in the field right now?
Oh, absolutely. Brand new head coach who just came in like literally weeks ago because they had a disastrous situation where their last head coach was fired after using a word he shouldn't have used in the locker room. They just don't have the talent to keep up with anybody in the league right now. They've been pretty tight with their purse strings, although it is obviously their second year as an expansion team that feeds a lot into it. Atlanta United, you know, I'm going to be curious to see what happens tonight. They lost that first game against the Red Bulls. That's kind of a rivalry matchup. They don't have their leading scorer in Joseph Martinez, who's recovering from a knee injury. They have some talent in Pity Martinez and Ezequiel Barco, South Americans, who are very good, but they just couldn't figure it out, the pattern to play in that first game against New York, who makes it hard on you because they do press you in a way that Cincinnati's not going to. Although I also have seen that Frank DeBoer tends to maybe rotate a little bit tonight, probably because of the heat, probably because of the humidity, probably because especially Cincinnati's not very good and he maybe feels he has the luxury to do so. So I have no idea what to make of Atlanta right now because they're coming out of this without one of their leading goal scorers. And at the same time, Cincinnati's so bad that it's almost impossible to imagine Atlanta not getting a win.
Yeah. Let's go to that Toronto team that you had mentioned, taking on Montreal. Three-way here, Toronto +110, Montreal +225, a draw is +275. The total's 2.5. This is that Toronto team that was in that 2-2 draw with the 2-0 first half lead and then fell apart, right? So what do you make of this matchup here?
Well, they look good for the most part against DC, except giving up those two goals. There was a bit of bad blood between those teams because of some scheduling and the way that TFC has conducted themselves coming into the tournament. Not that I blame them. They didn't necessarily want to arrive when the league said to arrive based on some positive tests. However, this game is interesting because it is a legitimate rivalry game. I mean, Montreal and Toronto, just as cities, don't like each other all that much. You have to wonder if that's going to come to play in this. Thierry Henry did some interesting tactical things in his first match, which is obviously a loss to New England. I expect that he'll change it up, but that kind of leaves open what that means. I would feel pretty good about Toronto in this match, but you know, again, with the rust and some of the other factors, it's kind of hard to know what Montreal is going to bring to the table because they looked relatively competent before the shutdown.
This is an interesting one too. And I'm going to tie in the futures on this, this last one on what's today, Wednesday. So tomorrow, Thursday, Columbus and the New York Red Bulls. Columbus is +140, +180 for the Red Bulls on the three-way line. The draw is +260. So Columbus slightly favored in the matchup. Here's the thing that I find interesting though, is the fact that if you look at the futures market, the New York Red Bulls are ahead of Columbus in terms of the futures market to win this whole thing, 9-1 compared to 14-1 for Columbus. So like, at least in that regard, it's a little weird that the Red Bulls are not favored in this matchup. What do you make of this one?
Well, I think that that's partly because the Red Bulls are traditionally the stronger team, at least the last couple of seasons. And Columbus is a bit of a, I wouldn't say a rebuild, but they've revamped this season. Caleb Porter came in as head coach last year and made them better, but they were just, you know, one step short of where they want to be. They went out and signed Lucas Zelarayán, who's an Argentinian player, scored a fantastic goal in their opener against Cincinnati. Obviously, not a lot of defense being played by Cincinnati, so you have to keep that in mind here. I think Columbus has enough talent to win the whole tournament. I really do. I just, you know, that's, it's a question though, with the way this thing plays out. I would say that Columbus is probably rightly favored in the game. I might have them as a favorite over the Red Bulls to win the whole tournament, but I imagine that that's a lot about where the Red Bulls come from, but they also let a couple of key veterans go last season. And while they still have some talent and they still have some guys who are stepping up, they're more of I think they're more of a question in terms of what they can possibly be. But their style also is a significant part of it. The Red Bulls, as I said, they press you. They make it difficult to play. If you're not good on the ball, that can tear you apart pretty quickly. I think Columbus has the ability to play through and around the Red Bulls when necessary. But it's going to be an interesting matchup because these two teams, if this was the normal world, both of them would be playoff contenders in the Eastern Conference, and we'd be talking about them maybe as dark horses to win the whole league.
Which of these groups is the strongest? Like by my initial observations, A seems pretty strong. I know Orlando, Philadelphia both have cemented their position in the knockout stage. New York City FC has been up there in terms of the future odds as well. I know they're weighed down by Inter Miami, but what do you make of, in terms of the group strength, which of the group is the strongest in your mind?
Let's see. I think Group D is interesting if you're talking about just the parity within the group. RSL, Minnesota, Sporting, and Colorado. None of them jump off the page. And again, Minnesota made the playoffs last year. Real Salt Lake did as well. But none of them were legal leaked. Sporting came off a very bad season, but they've added some pieces. Alan Pulido was great in the first two games of the year before the shutdown. I expect him to be a factor here in this tournament. Colorado made a lot of strides towards the end of the season. They didn't look very good in that opener against RSL, so who knows? Maybe there's still a lot of questions there. And then I think Group F is just going to be fascinating. I mean, LAFC is the best team in the league without their best player, which is interesting. LA Galaxy also missing a major midfield piece in Jonathan Dos Santos, but they have Chidoya Hernandez, and they're expecting him to do things. They lost that opener against Portland, and Portland is always up for a scrap. They're always in for a fight, and they do kind of veer between really, really good and kind of mediocre. So I think it's a fascinating group with the Dynamo thrown in with a new head coach in Tom Ramos, who I think a lot of people in soccer respect and think can get something extra out of that team.
Jason Davis again over on SiriusXM FC. Jason, we're up against it, but tell people where they can find your work.
No, I mean, go to SiriusXM FC, channel 157 from noon to 3 Eastern daily, and hit me up on Twitter, DavisJSN.
Thanks a lot, man. Appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you, guys.
Yep. Again, Jason Davis, good insight again. Just one game tonight, but three tomorrow in the MLS is back tournament. Seems to be a relatively good matchup too tonight. San Jose is the odds on favorite over Vancouver with the draw plus 295. This tournament is interesting though, man, especially those totals that we were talking about. You know, I did a little groupthink on Twitter. There's a lot of people smarter than me when it comes to at least following the intricacies of this. We'll see if these hold up, but these second halves have been a lot higher scoring than we've seen in the first half. And we'll see maybe if that continues later tonight. All right. When we come back, pucking around, we have Edmonton and Chicago up on deck. Oh, yeah. We don't need any of that wussy music. This is hockey, man. We need something hard. Yes, Edmonton Oilers, Chicago Blackhawks, our series preview today. Really excited for this series, mainly because obviously there's some pretty good names and some guys with some storied histories in the National Hockey League. But also, price-wise, seems to be a very tightly contested series. So let's talk about this for a second. Edmonton opens up as a $1.50 favorite in the series price, now in the range of about $1.70, depending on where you look. So bet up 20 cents. And again, I'll walk you through the process here, what I use. You start, for me at least, offense versus defensive zone, a goaltender for one team, and then flip it on its head, go the other way. So we'll look at Edmonton offensively, because from a traditional standpoint, you know, I think they kind of have like an average offense, the Edmonton Oilers, tied for 14th in goals per game at 3.14, 29th in shots per game at 29.6. And if you look at their analytical profile, it's actually not that much better. The Oilers below league average and even strength expected goals for at 142. Not by much. League average is 143.9 for expected goals for. But the other part of this is where they really lag, the high danger chances for the Edmonton Oilers at even strength this season, just 181, which is well below the league average of 203. And you see the analytical matchup here between these two. So you have traditional goals, you have shots. And again, this is Chicago's defensively, right? So this is going to be, of course, goals allowed, shots allowed, expected goals for and against, and then high danger chances allowed here. So you're seeing some of the offensive numbers that I'm talking to you about, right? Pretty low on the high danger chances for Edmonton's offense. 142 is below average, but kind of right on par with expected goals for. And when I'm going through what the Edmonton Oilers are, what it seems to me at least is it's a team that is kind of reliant on two guys, maybe three. We'll talk about the third. But Leon Draisaitl and Connor McDavid have combined for 77 of the team's 223 goals, 207 of the team's 604 points. And if you look at some other teams, and look, maybe this is a bad example because Vegas is a pretty deep team, but by comparison, Vegas has six guys with at least 46 points, four guys with 20 plus goals. Edmonton has three in each category, right? And the two guys at the top are extremely skilled But at the same time, I think you want a little bit more depth, right? Your top two lines are your threats here. And then after that, there's not much. And their third biggest threat, of course, being Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, who skates on the top line with McDavid. So, well, that could be an issue for Edmonton down the road. The question I think you have to ask is it going to be against Chicago? So if we could throw that analytical profile back up, you'll see that Chicago defensively has quite a few issues outside of goaltender, which we'll get to in a second. But they rank tied for 16th in goals per game against, right, 306, 31st in shots against per game at 35.1. What's even more troubling, though, if you look at the even strength analytics again. So we're talking about expected goals against for the Chicago Blackhawks, 173.5, well below the league average of 143.9. And they've also allowed 252 high danger chances to opponents. Remember, the league average there is 203. So you're giving up a lot of high danger chances. The expected goals for is massive for a team like Chicago Blackhawks. So, well, you look at Edmonton and you realize that once you get past their top two lines at even strength, there's not much. Chicago has a real disadvantage, it seems, at least statistically, on the defensive end of the floor. Now, they do have a really solid presence between the pipes, right, and Corey Crawford. Crawford's been great this season, 917 save percentage, 277 goals against in 39 starts. The question, of course, is can Crawford do enough with a garbage defense in front of him, especially when these two teams are at even strength? Oh, and by the way, on top of it, the Edmonton Oilers have the best power play in the National Hockey League as well. So that's going to be a massive issue for you, too. If you're Chicago, you got to stay out of the box, because if you do go down a man on the ice, then this is the best power play in the National Hockey League on top of two of the best scorers in the National Hockey League that could really beat you down on that end of the floor. So the Blackhawks offensively on the other side, by the way, not that far behind Edmonton as a whole, right? 297 in terms of the goals per game, good for 18th in the league, average 31.8 shots per game, 13th highest mark in the National Hockey League. Chicago also has the better overall analytical profile if you look at them offensively, right? You're talking about the 155.4 expected goals for, 233 in terms of the high danger chances, both numbers better than what Edmonton does as an offensive whole. The problem here with Chicago is, despite the fact that their high danger chances are so high, their high danger chance conversion rate well below league average at 10.4%. So while they're generating these high danger looks, they're not cashing in on them. Now, from a goaltender standpoint, Edmonton, really, I think it's kind of a wash here. They have two guys who they'll cycle through up to this point when you look at what they bring on the table, from goaltender's perspective. Mike Smith, Mikko Koskinen, combined to post a 910 save percentage, 285 goals against. It's actually pretty much on par with what Crawford brings to the table. So altogether, it seems like the price was right on, at least at minus 150, up to minus 160, 70. I get why Edmonton's getting some support, but priced out at this point, especially when you're up in the range of minus 170. A reminder, VSiN Plus subs are free until a major sport returns, so check that out at VSiN.com/subscribe. Point Spread Weekly is out. Increase that betting IQ, people. Go to VSiN.com/subscribe. UFC Fight Night Island 1, Fight Island 1, coming up next. All right, make sure you're ready for the action. Sign up for First Bet, a new betting and handicapping product from ExpressBet. Use a promo code Vegas500. Get a $10 free bet as soon as you sign up. Plus, receive up to a $500 bonus for wagering in your first 30 days. Visit first.com/bet for more information. 1st.com/BET. Again, that's first.com/bet. The promo code is Vegas500. The show is The Edge here on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network. The host is me, Jonathan Von Tobel. All right, UFC Fight Island 1. To recap very quickly, yesterday we talked a little bit about the main event, Calvin Kattar versus Dan Ige. This number's gone up too, by the way. This is now in the range of like 315, depending on when you look for Calvin Kattar. I get the love for Calvin Kattar. He's a really phenomenal striker. He's a lot of fun to watch. The combinations are dangerous. We talked yesterday about all the finishes that he's got really coming way because of those combinations that he can land. I think Dan Ige is a little bit better than this. And again, we're talking in the range of now over 75% in terms of implied probability for Kattar to win this fight. I'm not sure I'm there. I'm not sure if it's that much of a, you know, that much of an opportunity to be given. I don't know. I don't think it's that likely that Calvin Kattar is going to win this fight. He should be favored. Don't get me wrong. I expected this in the range of maybe minus 200. I can maybe get 250, but now over $3, really interesting. from that perspective. But the other two fights that I really wanted to get into that I'm interested in, Tim Elliott taking on Ryan Benoit, flyweight bout. Elliott opened up about $1.20, Benoit even money, now up to $1.40 on Elliott over at William Hill and a couple of other shops. Round prop of 2.5. Over minus $1.55. Look, Elliott more than likely, if we can throw up these analytical profiles right, more than likely Elliott wants this fight, at least on the ground in the clinch. He averages 4.31 successful takedowns every 15 minutes. He's clearly not comfortable with the feet. You look at the net significant strike differential, and while it's positive and better than Benoit's at this point, plus 0.88. And again, so I was having this thought process as I was, you know, watching a couple of these fights and studying. And as you guys know, if you've watched the show, getting more into analytics in terms of the mixed martial arts and applying them to the handicap. But I would think a guy who lands 4.3 takedowns every 15 minutes is more apt to land some significant strikes and ground and pound. And the fact that Elliott is so close to being dead even in terms of the net significant strike differential kind of worries me, because I feel like if you're landing that many takedowns, if you're spending that much time on top, then you should be able to at least outland some significant strikes on your opponents. But it tells me, and again, this is kind of the process, right, of using these analytics, and there's more that we can dive into once we get more comfortable with these, but it does tell me a little bit that from a stand-up perspective, he's not going to be comfortable at all. And Benoit, as a striker, and he's got some heavy hands, he's got a little bit of power, but obviously, as you can tell by the numbers, he's got a negative net significant strike differential. Again, this is the differential between significant strikes landed per minute versus significant strikes absorbed per minute. So Benoit is near even, but he's getting about 0.4 significant strikes landed on him more, or he's absorbing 0.4 more than he's landing on his opponent at this point. But Benoit, he doesn't want to take this down, right? 0.2 in terms of the takedown average every 15 minutes. This is a game that he wants to do. He wants to stand up. He wants to fight. He wants to see if he can strike with you a little bit. He's got a penchant for finishing too, man. He's got 10 wins in his professional career. 8 of them have come via knockout and TKO. And all of this combined, right? I'm looking at all of this. And by the way, Elliott too, and maybe I'm just not a fan of his, like watching some of his old fights. Look, he's lost 3 straight bouts, 4 of 5 and 5 of 7. And in those losses, of those 5 losses, he's been submitted 3 times. One of them just kind of rushing into a clinch and then getting submitted really quickly. But if you just look at it overall, I just don't think Elliott's really that good. And maybe I'm reading this incorrectly, but now that it was up to $1.40, I bet Ryan Benoit at plus +120. Just early this morning after I got finished with some of the numbers in the research. So I'm not sure. I wasn't comfortable, obviously, going to Method of Victory. But I think if you look, too, by the way, haven't even gotten to the fact that the takedown defense for Benoit, while not really great at 64%, is still better than what Elliott brings to the table. And maybe he can sprawl out, keep this on the feet. And that's where he wants this against Elliott. The other, of course, Jimmy Rivera. Right now, Cody Stamann, featherweight bout, Rivera minus -135 on the open rounds, 2.5. If you look at the net significant strike differential, right, Stamann really gets this one in terms of the differential, 0.22 on the positive side for Rivera, just plus 1.34 for Cody in this matchup. And the takedown average is the big difference, right? Rivera wants to stand up. Right. You could tell that by the takedown average and not even landing a full takedown every 15 minutes. It's at 0.7. Stamann, on the other hand, 3.34. And I think this is why Rivera's favored. This is why the edge is to Rivera and why I like him in this matchup. And this has been bet up to about $1.50. Rivera's takedown defense is really good. He's at 95% right now, man. He's built like an ox. He can keep himself up against some of these guys who want to take him down. And I think he'll be able to do that here, right? Unlike the matchup we just talked about, where the guy I'm talking about in Benoit has a 64% takedown defense. We're talking about Rivera, who's got a 95%. Now, the question, of course, is, I think the response, right, is, well, Rivera's dropped 3 of 4. His form isn't that good. Look at the level of competition that he's faced up to this point, though, man. He was 20. Remember, too, he only had 1 loss, obviously, coming in to, was it last June or whatever it was. But look at his last losses for him have been Marlon Moraes, Aljamain Sterling, and Petrion, all 3 guys competing for a title in that division. Aljamain Sterling's probably the next guy up. Jan just won the belt, and Moraes just lost a belt shot, right? So like, this is everything that we're talking about in terms of Rivera. So while he's not in great form, the 3 guys that he has faced are absolutely near the top of this division and in the Ultimate Fighting Championship overall. So I look at this in terms of what Rivera, and I think this guy, despite the fact that, you know, his significant striking defensively is not that great, I like Rivera a lot in what he's done. And you even go back to the Jan fight, you know, Jan won that one decision. Or did he win that decision? I'll have to go back and look at that one. But the Jan fight, for the first round, he was up there with Yanni. He was mixing it up and making him feel relatively uncomfortable. I like what Rivera brings to the table for the most part. Now, again, I think $1.50 is probably where this is at. And I'm not sure if he's got it within him to finish. And this is why you see this in this round prop too. And you've been completely priced out up to this point. 2.5 over -380 for this round prop. I mean, that's obviously massive. So now maybe this is one of those where if you're uncomfortable, if you don't want to bet something, you know, at least in terms of the odds, -380, right? We talked about -300 and the implied probability there. -380 is massive. And so maybe this is something where if you handicap one side or the other, and thank you, Jacob, for telling me, yeah, it was by decision. I thought I was thinking of something else. So he did lose to Jan by decision. I'm talking about Jimmy Rivera, by the way. But if you're looking at this from the round prop perspective, the way you handicap this, if you think Stamen or Rivera is going to win this fight, maybe you do look at this like something like via decision. I mean, if we're talking about over 2.5 -380, then maybe you'd feel comfortable betting an index prop in that range. But right now, the only play that I have was Benoit taking on Tim Elliott at this point at +120. Again, I got that at William Hill. Still playing with what I want to do in the first match, because I do think that Cater's going to win this, but I think Dan Ige is pretty disrespected, at least in terms of this price. Maybe again, taking a crack at like a Cater by decision, because that's actually in the range of +260, +270. And him winning via knockout or TKO is the odds on favorite, but I'm not sure I'm there with Cater up to this point. All right, when we come back, we have plenty left to get to in the last few minutes. Done with Fight Island, now on to the bubble in Orlando with nothing but analytics. It's New Orleans Pelicans up on deck when we return here on The Edge. If you're a sports fan and you haven't been to BetRivers Sportsbook, come on, you're missing out. BetRivers is live streaming a massive number of sporting events every day from around the world. You can watch live soccer, tennis, baseball, and more right on your phone. Sign up now for the BetRivers Sportsbook app. Get up to $250 bonuses on your first deposit. The best part of this offer is that all bonuses are only one-time playthrough. All those 5, 10, and 20-time playthrough offers can take a hike. One time is the only way to go. Go to BetRivers Sportsbook today. Start your winning streak. Sign up now. Get up to $250 match on your first deposit. All bonuses are a one-time playthrough. There's no faster way to turn your bonus cash into real cash. Download the BetRivers Sportsbook app today. Got to be 21 or older. Playable in Colorado, Illinois, Indiana, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. If you have a gambling problem, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Indiana, 1-800-9-WITH-IT. Colorado, 1-800-522-4700. Playable in New Jersey as PlaySugarHouse.com. All right. We have plenty to get to. Let's do it. Paul Howard? Paul Howard? No? I was going to be Paul. All right. Welcome back into my humble abode. People make fun of me for my room, by the way, if I could actually turn the camera, but it'd be unprofessional. I have literally nothing on the walls in this room except for this one corner where I have all this stuff. It looks absolutely fantastic when you walk in. Nothing but analytics. Speaking of absolutely fantastic, the New Orleans Pelicans. Everybody loves the New Orleans Pelicans. So let's talk a little bit about what the Pelicans bring to the table. We'll start offensively because this has become somewhat of a darling team, despite the fact that since Zion's come back, they're only two games above 500, but we'll get to that. Let's talk about this team offensively. All right. Clearly a really skilled offensive team when you break down their numbers, like literally from any perspective, right? They thrive in key areas of the floor. And if you've watched this, if you watch me, if you read any of the work too, you know how much I love this new wave of basketball, right? And the efficiency of taking care of three-point line at the rim and free throws. I love James Harden, even though all of you hate him. But look at this, right? Three-point shooting. They're one of the best three-point shooting teams in the NBA. Overall, three-point shooting, 37.9%, third best rate in the National Basketball Association. They're a fast team as well. They get out in transition, second in pace behind Milwaukee at 103.96 possessions per game while maintaining that efficiency. You look at that right there, fast break efficiency, seventh best in the NBA, 126.8 points per 100 possessions. And even a look at the areas of the floor in which they thrive reveals that team, right, that's playing basketball 2020 style, that 37.2% of their attempts come at the rim. That's the eighth most in the NBA. They shoot 63.5%, which is 12th best in the NBA. We talked about the shooting, at least in terms of percentage from beyond the arc, but the fact that they take 38.2% of their attempts from three-point range, which is seventh most in the NBA. So not only are they taking a lot of threes, they're hitting a lot of threes. You'll love to see the way that they play basketball. Now, this is the other part about it, too. The offensive weakness that I have listed there in terms of mid-range shooting, I mean, you put it there because they ranked 23rd, right? 38.3%. Well, guess what? They actually ranked 24th in terms of frequency of attempts in mid-range. So they don't even take that many mid-range shots. And I would think a good majority of theirs, like we've talked about before, right? Like my issue with trying to put my finger on what is mid-range shooting in terms of frequency and all these teams, and there's some teams that are built around it. Other teams, though, who shoot a lot of threes have a relatively high mid-range shooting percentage. Maybe it's because these guys are inside the line that they don't expect it, but this is a team that does not take mid-range shots, and you love to see it. So overall, I have a team offensively that gets up and down the floor, that is relatively successful at the rim, that shoots a lot of threes and hits a lot of threes. It's all things that you really like to see. Now, the small issue with their offense, of course, is twofold, right? One is the lack of free throws. As a team, their free throw rate is just 18.5, which means they're only making 18.5 free throws every 100 possessions. You want that rate higher, especially, again, remember I told you, they're a team that takes, right, 37.2% of their attempts at the rim. So you're the eighth, you rank eighth in terms of frequency at the rim, and yet you rank in the bottom half of the league in terms of free throw rate, 23rd. Not good, right? So you want to be able to draw fouls. And the other thing, too, is the glaring weakness really comes when you slow them down. Like, clearly when you slow them down, they're not comfortable. Half court efficiency, and we have that listed in the offensive weaknesses for the New Orleans Pelicans, 94.9 points per 100 possessions. When the game slows down, so do the New Orleans Pelicans. They don't really like it. They want to get out in transition. They have the youth to do it. They have the shooters to do it. And thus, when you slow them down and force them to play that half court game, their offense really falls off and they struggle quite a bit with what they want to do. But overall, really like what the New Orleans Pelicans do offensively. Defensively is where it comes in, where I'm like really intrigued and kind of like, I don't know what to do with this team. So let's just, we'll start with this, right? They rank 20th in overall defensive efficiency. Okay. And this is season long numbers. We'll get to Zion in a second, but they allow 111.6 points per 100 possessions. Since Zion has made his debut, right, their defensive rating dropped to 109.2 points per 100 possessions. That would put them at about 15th this season in terms of defensive efficiency. So better, but still about essentially, actually, exactly average for an NBA team, right? So let's look at some of the numbers, because I don't know. There's an odd thing going on with some of their numbers, and you'll see this right now. Take the rim numbers, for example, right? New Orleans ranks 10th in opponent shooting within 4 feet of the basket. They only give up 62.4% at the rim. However, they rank 29th in terms of opponent attempts within 4 feet. So opponents are taking 39.5% of their attempts at the rim, but they're only shooting 62.4%. So they're getting to the basket, they're just not finishing. And to me, that's kind of a red flag, right? Like, if you're letting guys get to the rim, the shooting should be better for their opponents, and yet it's not. So why is that? So there's two things that kind of stuck out for me when you really dive into some of these numbers. One, they do rank 12th in blocks per game, right? They're blocking opponents 5.1 blocks per game. So that's a factor, right? Guys are getting to within 4 feet of the basket, and yet they're decent at protecting the rim, 5.1 blocks per game, really solid for a team, again, in the top half of the NBA at 12th. And they even guard the perimeter relatively well, allowing just 34.4% on non-corner three-point attempts, right? So here's the thing, though. Again, tying this back to what's going on with the rim, rebounding. And we've talked about this with a couple of teams now where you have some relatively good defensive numbers, but the glaring weakness comes in rebounding, and the rebounding will kill you, right? Opponents are grabbing 25.7% of their misses against New Orleans. That's 20th in the NBA. Then you look at where they struggle defensively, and it starts to make a little bit more sense, right? It explains the frequency of attempts at the rim. Guys are getting to the rim. They're either getting blocked or they're missing, but they're able to get their rebounds and either finish at the rim or maybe kick it out. So then the response is, well, John, you just told me that perimeter wise, they're actually not that great. They're really solid in terms of what they give up to opponents. Yeah, they are in terms of non-corner three-point percentage. If you look at corner three-point percentage for opponents for the New Orleans Pelicans, that's 40.3%. That's 21st in the NBA, right? They also rank in the bottom half of the league in terms of second chance points per game. They're giving up 13.2 second chance points per game. So all of this together, right? You have really solid numbers at the rim. You got really solid numbers in terms of the non-corner three-point shooting from a defensive perspective. But The rebounding numbers aren't great. You're giving up a lot of offensive rebounds. You're giving up a lot of corner threes. And what's the recipe for open 3-point shots, right? When you're talking about basketball, it's not only driving kicks, but it's offensive rebounds. How many times does an offensive rebound lead to an open shooter for your opponent? It happens all the time. And so it explains the fact that they give up a lot of second chance points, the fact that the corner 3-point shooting is actually really poor for the New Orleans Pelicans, because I think sometimes they have trouble keeping opponents off of the glass. And it even goes into something like half court efficiency, right? Defensively, they rank 19th in terms of half court efficiency. Again, speaking to the fact that they want to get up and down the floor, not only did they struggle offensively in that realm, but they struggled defensively as well at 95.6. So all of this together, I'm really intrigued. Like, this team's, it's good. They're good, right? Don't get me wrong. I just think we've talked about this from the market perspective, right? In terms of putting New Orleans like on a neutral 1 point behind a Boston Celtics, something like that. Like, the market likes this team, and I can understand why you like this team. But at the same time, to have them in terms of power rating, just 1 point behind the Boston Celtics, in terms of the futures market, to have them identical with the Oklahoma City Thunder, who are not going to miss the playoffs and are in, and the New Orleans Pelicans have to fight their way in, right? There's just some things that I think are a little bit worrisome. Now, we also have Jacob. I don't know if we have this or not, the Zion Williamson numbers, because we'll walk through, because I think one of the things that's been a little overblown with the Zion Williamson return, and he's awesome and he's made them great, and he's going to be an awesome player for a very long time. But like, we forget, and I brought this up with Mitch and Paul, and I brought this up on this show, that like, they're only two games above 500 since Zion's come back. And look, there's some really good numbers, like efficiency wise offensively, right? 2.6 or plus 2.6, which means their offensive rating goes up by 2.6 points per 100 possessions when he's on the floor. The offensive rebounding rate goes up for the New Orleans Pelicans when he's on the floor by 5.6%. The rim frequency, the frequency of which they take shots at the rim, look at that. It skyrockets 15.7% more. They're going to go to the rim with Zion Williamson on the floor there. The thing that I think hurts a little bit, right, is the fact that their 3-point shooting falls off. Like, that's a big strength for the New Orleans Pelicans. And when Zion's on the floor, they're going to take 7.4% less in terms of 3-point shots. That's something that's going to hurt them, and their fast break efficiency. That's the big thing here with Zion on the floor, right? Look at their fast break efficiency. According to Cleaning the Glass, drops off by 10.9 points per 100 possessions. That's pretty big, man. For a team that thrives going up and down the floor, that's massive. Now, the big difference for Zion, as you can see, the defensive numbers, they're immense what he does for them defensively. And maybe that's the trade-off. Maybe that's worth not being as effective in the fast break, because defensively, their defensive rating drops by 9.6 points per 100 possessions. That's freaking good. That's awesome. You see the numbers in terms of the 3-point shooting for opponents, 5.1% worse. Awesome. Half-court efficiency improves by 5.4 points per 100 possessions defensively. And the fast break efficiency defensively improves by 3 points per 100 possessions. So he brings a lot to the table on defense. You just fall off in some key categories on offense. And I wonder if that's going to be worth the trade-off. Like, when you're a team that thrives so much running up and down the floor on offense, do you really want to trade? I shouldn't say, do you really want to? You want to with Zion because he's so good. But I wonder how that affects them over a very long haul. And again, right, they were good with Zion Williamson, but they're only two games over 500. So we'll see how good they can be. And again, we're talking about the eighth seed, right? So we're talking about the right to face the Los Angeles Lakers and get eliminated in however amount of games. And theoretically, who's the better matchup for the Los Angeles Lakers, Memphis or New Orleans? Probably maybe New Orleans, maybe because they get up and down the floor. And shockingly enough, the Lakers aren't really that great of a fast break defensive team. But anyway, that does it for and nothing but analytics. And that does it for The Edge. Make sure to check out everything at VSiN.com/podcasts. If you missed out on any part of the show, great MLS spot at the top. So a big thank you again for Jason Davis, who welcomed us and gave us a couple of minutes. With that, we will see you tomorrow here on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network.